Your child's own journey. Our kids have their own lives. Sometimes it's hard for us to remember this because when we start raising them, they're so little, and we seem to have total control over every minute of their day. At first, we decide when they're going to eat and when they're going to sleep and when they're going to turn this way and that way. We actually position their bodies. We put them here, we put them there. We have, at the beginning of their lives, so much control over them that it's hard for us to realize as time goes on that we actually don't have that control anymore. And even at the beginning, even though we seemed to have some control because we could put them here or put them there, you know, take them with us or leave them behind or whatever we wanted to do, we actually didn't have total control even then. Some of us who've had colicky babies who scream and cry no matter what we do have learned in the early days of parenting that we don't have total control. Others who were more successful at being able to soothe and calm a baby because the baby was responsive to their soothing and calming maneuvers, some of those people actually were deluded temporarily into thinking that they had some control. Oh, if you just rock the baby this way or pat the baby this way, you know, you can get that baby to calm down. That's what, you know, a parent might say to another parent if they've had that successful experience. But most of us, no matter how it started, soon realize, let's say by the time the child is crawling, that we have less control than we thought originally. Now the child is not listening, not doing what we want him or her to do. And there, you know, therein lies the rub, shall we say, that we want the child to do something, and the child is free to do what he or she wants to do. The child has a free will. And we parents are interacting with that child's free will all the time. Now, we're so happy when that child's free will aligns well with our own will, our own desires in life. So when the child does what we want the child to do because the child has actually chosen to align himself with us, then we still feel like, oh, good, we're still in control of this process. I can get this child to go to bed, because when I say go to bed, he turns around and marches off towards the bed. Isn't that great? Or I can get that child to sit down and do his homework, because when I say do the homework, the child actually cooperates. Again, for those parents who have kids who are so cooperative, we again think that we have a lot of control. A lot of other parents find that, gosh, when I tell my kid to go to bed, he marches the other way. And when I tell him to do the homework, he puts up such a fuss and does not cooperate. I realize even now the child is 8 or 9 or whatever years old, that I can't make the kid do anything. So there's this dance that goes on, let's say, in the first decade of trying to find how much power we have and how much power we don't have. But by the time the child is an adolescent, surely we are realizing that we don't have hardly any power at all. Because now the child is really moving around freely in the world. Before, we seemed to think maybe we could choose the child's friends. You know, maybe we could select the play dates and move the child into a certain position. And again, sometimes it seems like that worked. For some parents, you pick some friends for your kids to play with in the early years, and voila, they play. So it seems like you were able to do that maneuver, to control them that way. And other parents found at the same stage that if their child didn't like that person, they just wouldn't be playing no matter how many play dates you arranged or how you try to encourage that friendship to develop. It just doesn't develop because your child will have none of it. But by the time the child gets to adolescence, then we know, really, that we can't make the kid play with anybody. Although we know it intellectually, we still may be struggling with the child's free will. Because as the child is 12 or 14 or 17, however old the child is, and is now choosing friends and associations that we don't like, you know, the most we can say to the child is, I don't like your friends, they're not good for you, please choose some other people. But we know that we can't stop the child from talking to those people, seeing those people, communicating with them in a wide variety of ways. It's just if a child wants to pursue a friendship, the child will. And a lot of people have found out the hard way also that if you specifically try to forbid a friendship when you're dealing with an older child, an older teen particularly, you're practically ushering the child right to that relationship, because kids at that age have a strong, strong desire to assert their free will, to become independent human beings. So although we want so much for our kids, and I think I've said this little list before somewhere, but it's worth repeating, we lack control in very basic areas of their lives. For example, we don't have control over our kids, whether our kids will be happy, or whether they'll be mentally healthy or physically healthy, or whether they're going to be successful in school, or whether they're going to have lots of friends or the right friends, or when they get older, whether they're going to have the kind of career that we want them to have, or whether they're going to get married or stay married. We can't control how they're getting along with their siblings, or what they think, or what they believe, what kind of life they're going to choose. We can certainly expose them to a lot of things, but we can't control what they're going to do and how they're going to feel. You know, there's many more things that we can't control, but let's just, you know, start with that beginning list, which is depressing enough. There's just so much in the child's domain, because the child is on her own journey. The child has a life to lead with specific challenges that Hashem put into the child's world. And these can include the experiences that the child has at school with certain teachers or certain peers. This can include experiences that are unpleasant, such as being mistreated by a teacher, or having unfair things happen at school, having a bully pursue a child. Or it can also include the way the child's brain works, what Hashem has decided to give the child in terms of a thinking process. Does the child have learning disabilities or attention deficits or developmental delays? Does the child have mental health challenges that Hashem planted there, like a tendency towards anxiety or vulnerability in the mood department? Even the birth order of the child has been determined not by you exactly, but by Hashem. Hashem has given the child, this child, this particular older sibling and this particular younger sibling, perhaps this particular very difficult sibling that sucks the life out of the family. And now you're feeling really bad for the innocent child, let's say, who has to deal with a very challenging or challenged sibling. And you're feeling bad as if it was something you did, but it wasn't in your control to create that situation. And in fact, it is the situation that Hashem wants for this child's journey, that Hashem gives us everything we need in order to become a certain kind of person and to fulfill our own individual life mission. If your child happens to need a rough school experience, then no matter what you do, you know, that child will have that rough school experience, and Hashem will see to it that it occurs. You know, whether that's being a victim of bullies or mean children or social problems, no matter how many schools you switch the child to, if that's supposed to be part of the child's history, then even though you took the child to therapist, you know, if the therapist is supposed to help, then it will help. But if it's not supposed to help at that point in the child's life, then it won't help, right? And we can't save our children from pain, struggle, difficult experiences, you know, unfair experiences. We can't save our child from world events, the political situation, you know, just whatever's going on. We cannot protect our child and leave them in a bubble of good experiences and happy feelings and wonderful, you know, everything, because that was never the way it was meant to be for anybody. The way we're organized, the way we're made, is that we have to have happy experiences in our lives, and we have to have difficult and challenging experiences to deal with so that our soul develops its full capacities. As Rabbi Hirsch explains, the soul cannot become strong and fully developed if it only has happy and pleasant experiences. We all have to be challenged. Those challenges start off in childhood. So Hashem arranges them. So even though we want to take control of the child's life and give him only good teachers and fair situations and happy, you know, situations with good friends and good neighbors and, you know, just good everything, we will not be able to do that. Our child will find whatever friends, teachers, and whatever experiences she needs in order to develop according to her mission in life. In addition to those areas of lack of control, we have the things that happen as the child gets older and her own personality becomes clearer, so that we can see again that we are lacking control. As the child gets older, we said the child is choosing friends, whether you like them or don't like them. The child is also choosing clothing, her style, what she likes. Now, you can make rules in your house about what a child is allowed to wear, but you can't follow a child around as she goes to school or goes to out in, you know, with her friends in public places or whatever. You can't follow her around to make sure she's still wearing what you want her to wear. And even in your house, some people have discovered that they can't make their three-year-old wear, you know, those blue rubbers if he doesn't want to wear those blue rubbers, right? Or some children assert their style independence from a young age, but if they haven't done it then surely they will do it by the time they are adolescents. So if it turns out that you approve of and like your child's taste in clothing and style and what the child wants to do, that's great. But what if you don't, and you feel that, you know, you yourself would not wear those colors, that style, those kinds of clothes? It's hard, even if there's nothing particularly wrong with the clothes. If they're different and unappealing to you, that may be enough to feel frustrated that you can't make your child do it the right way, the better way, the way you think is good. You know, the way our child spends time, or what the child wants to do with his time, that can be an area that's out of control also. We may really want our kids to be big readers. We may go to the trouble of buying them books, reading them books, taking them to the library every week to help cultivate this. And still, we could be faced with a child who just doesn't read. Or we may have a child whose hobby and interest, their way they want to spend their free time, is just, you know, just totally not what we want. Whatever that is, you know, it's just the fact that we can't make the child like doing certain things. So if we want to, you know, teach a kid, let's say we believe that we have a value that it's good to teach kids to be domestic and that they should learn how to cook and sew and clean and all these things, well, in our family, we'll usually find a child or two who really likes to do that stuff. And we'll often find a child or two or more who really doesn't like to do that stuff. And we're going to worry, you know, what's going to be with you? You're not going to be able to take care of yourself. You know, everybody should learn to be independent. You know, we can fight it out. But we will realize that we have no control over what any child likes or doesn't like. So this can be frustrating also. And, you know, how much the child is academically inclined. Well, you know, it's a normal parental thing to want all of our kids to be academically inclined since they spend so many years in school and yeshiva. We want them to love to learn and to be good at it. And again, we have no control over whether they're good at it or not, and less control over whether they like it or not. You know, they may like it, they may not like it. Now, again, this is only a partial list of the limits of our power, which is not, we do have some power in parenting, but these places are not where that power lies, because our children have to be their own individual people. They have to do their own learning and have their own experiences, and sometimes they have to learn things the hard way, while we parents have to stand back helplessly and watch them make big mistakes. Certainly when kids are adolescents, sometimes the mistakes are enormous. They are costly. They may be life-changing. You know, children sometimes do things that we just so badly don't want them to be doing. They experiment with drugs. They, you know, they drink and they drive. And no matter how much education and whatever we've provided for them, they're still free to experiment and learn and do their own thing. And of course, we get so, we feel our helplessness, our powerlessness to save them from their own mistakes. Well, what is the role of a parent if we can't make our children do too much? we have very little control. Sometimes from the earliest days, we just really lack control. What can we do about it? I mean, a lot of us, you know, we want to rescue our children from the things that are happening to them. If there is a mean teacher or something, we want to come in there and save our children from the unpleasantness of that experience. Now, you know, we do have to sometimes save our children. Sometimes it is the job of a parent to rescue and save and protect a helpless child. We have to make that call whether the situation is one a helpless child who is being abused in some way and who cannot take care of it by him or herself. Then the parent must take care of it. Okay, that's our job. We have to come in and help. But, you know, when is it that the child cannot take care of it, him or herself? What if it's just a teacher who, you know, is not the best teacher, sometimes says things that you wouldn't say as a parent, you know, is not using the nice technique or the sophisticated way or even the mentally healthy way of communicating with a child? But, you know, do you have to save your 11-year-old from that? Or would it be better for the child to deal with it herself somehow? Let's say the teacher was insulting, you know, said some remark which hurt the child's feelings. Is it better to come and speak to the teacher as a parent, or speak to the principal, to have the principal speak to the teacher? Is that what we should do because the child came home upset? And the child said, I don't like what, you know, Mrs. So-and-so said to me today. She said I was silly, and I'm not silly, and really hurt my feelings. You know, this is one of these times when we have to ask ourselves, what are we supposed to be doing? You know, are we supposed to be saving our children from every pain? Or are we supposed to be helping them to know that they can survive their own life, that they can cope with more things perhaps than they thought they could cope with? You know, our playgrounds are designed today that nobody should fall, nobody should hurt themselves. I mean, that's good because there were severe injuries on playgrounds at one point, and those are being reduced by taking dangerous things out of the playground. But, you know, the ultimate is don't go to the playground. Don't climb up on the climbing bars because you might fall down, right? And we don't want our children to be afraid of everything, to feel that they couldn't cope. I mean, if they fall down, maybe they're going to get a bruise. And after they get the bruise will heal and they'll carry on. That's, you know, we want them to know that they can heal from experiences that are not the way they want them to be, that they're not perfect experiences, especially in the world of human relationships, since they're always going to be flawed. They're always going to be imperfect. People will always make mistakes. Can we help our children build up a tolerance for other people's foibles by not rescuing a child who's 11 years old from a mild insult? It's hard for us, but I would say that if we want to help our child negotiate his own journey, we need to start pulling back our protection and support at a certain point. You know, and see if the child can survive it. Certainly, we want to provide emotional support to the child for all the bumps and bruises that the child gets, whether they're physical or emotional. So if a child does come home and, you know, my teacher called me silly and I'm not silly and I don't like it and you taught me we're not supposed to call people names and she's calling me names, right? So what can the parent do? Well, instead of running to correct the teacher, maybe we can start off with emotional coaching, that is naming the child's feelings, supporting her feelings, validating her feelings, letting the child know that you understand that she's hurt and that that wasn't nice and that her perceptions about it are correct, that it also wasn't the way we're supposed to behave. And then going on to say that sometimes people make mistakes and sometimes, you know, they slip and even though it's unpleasant, we need to be judge them, you know, positively at first. We don't let them make, there's a rule, you know, like you can make that mistake two or three times before you start having to not judge them positively, we could say, well, maybe the teacher was in a bad mood, maybe she was tired, maybe she forgot herself. But of course, if that problem has been going on for 6 months already, then the positive judgment on that is maybe nobody taught this teacher how to speak in a different way. Maybe this teacher didn't have the benefit of the education that you've had about how to be sensitive to people, and we need to feel sorry for her. And that doesn't take away the pain, you know, but it may soften the child's pain knowing that the teacher just doesn't know better, right? If that's, sometimes that's a reframe of what's going on for the child. Do we have to make the teacher stop? Again, we're talking here about not big abuses, but imperfections and inconsiderations and certainly less than perfect ways of dealing with things. So maybe we're going to teach the child that hearing an insult like that, according to Jewish thought, it wipes out a lot of the child's own mistakes. The sins that a child does or that a person does, right, are wiped out by the insults that we receive from others. So there's a little benefit there. We could say, well, you know, you sometimes make mistakes too. I sometimes hear how you call your sister, you know, some names also. And one benefit of your teacher accidentally, you know, doing this to you is that it cleanses your slate a little bit. And it helps remind you how important it is to be kind to other people too. So it's a learning experience. Maybe, you know, we can support our child and educate our child and guide our child without saving or rescuing our child, unless the child really needs to be rescued and saved. So we want our child to know that things can be imperfect. They can also make their own mistakes, never mind the teacher's mistakes, and that you will just stand by them without heavy criticism, without making them feel, you know, inadequate or stupid or wrong or bad because they've done some learning, but just being with them in a supportive way through their journey, so that when they're feeling pain from learning whatever they're learning, that you have sympathy and empathy for them, and you are somehow conveying a trust that you know that they'll figure it out. They'll figure out what kind of friends are good for them. Let's say they've picked some people who you know aren't good for them, and they've started to engage in activities with those people that you disapprove of and you know aren't good for them. And they get in trouble at school because of those activities and because of the friends they chose and the road they're going down. Well, a child can take a look at that and sometimes say, you know, maybe these people aren't the best for me. Usually after a good child, so to speak, you know, a normally well-behaved child has made some very poor choices, the child herself can say, you know, maybe this isn't so good for me. And at that point, the parent, you know, is not going to say, well, isn't that what I've been telling you all along? Isn't that what I've told you? It's fine time. It's about time you finally figured out it's not good for you. I hope you've learned your lesson. Okay, that's not support, right? What we want to do is just mirror the child's learning so that it's highlighted. And we say, well, you know, maybe that's true. You know, maybe you'll think about, you'll kind of look ahead and see where things could end up when you spend time with certain people. And I'm proud of you for coming up with that thought, you know, and just quietly move away and let the child have her freedom to make her own adjustments. So, you know, children will make mistakes. We said some of them, as the child gets older, some of those mistakes take a toll on the child's life and, you know, may have big cost. Again, particularly then, we don't want to say, I told you so, I told you, I warned you. Rather, we need to be there to be supportive of the child's learning journey, remembering that we ourselves have probably made a number of serious errors in our lives. I mean, we don't get really wise unless we've descended to a certain point where we've had to learn things. So, you know, at 20 or 30 or 40 years old, we probably made a lot of mistakes. Or if we're only 30 now, and then at, you know, 10, 15, 20, 25 years old, we've made mistakes, right? We were never perfect. So we want to be kind to the child and to help the child understand that doing things the wrong way and learning from those experiences is the human way. And we want to help ourselves constantly have faith in the child, in the faith in the child's ability to learn eventually, every child according to his or her own timetable, so that maybe the child will not really wisen up until he or she is 25 years old or 35 years old. Maybe it'll take till 45 years old, right? But our constant faith in the child's ability to negotiate his or her own journey will be communicated to the child through our just the attitude that we're really holding. Whereas we don't want to convey, you know, I don't think you can handle life. I think I need to protect you. I need to shelter you. I need to save you from yourself. I need to rescue you. I need to live it for you. I need to make your decisions for you, because I don't believe that you can actually stand up on your own two feet. I don't believe that you can handle any stress. I don't believe that you can learn from your experiences. Let me live your life for you, right? That would be the very opposite. So while it's hard, really hard, to realize that no matter what, the child has to make their own life, you know, right from the beginning and all the way through the end, and that we're just there as a guide, just there as a support, and just there to believe in the child and to point in the right direction, okay, to take that role. Even though it's hard, you know, we can do it when we're thinking about it, and when we do it, will be rewarded with a child who feels trusting towards us and really looks to us as a supportive guide in their journey. Not somebody who is pointing a finger, but somebody who's standing right beside them with an arm around their shoulder. And that's the best that we can be for our kids.